all of us. Everyone at the State's Academic Medical Center. All working together to deliver complete care now and for generations to come. All over the state, including hospital and clinic locations from the Delta to the Gulf Coast. All for one reason. You, the University of Mississippi Medical Center. All for your health.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Hi, I'm Dr. Susan Buttress, host of Southern Remedies, Relatively Speaking. Join the conversation every Tuesday at 11 as we dissect issues that are important to you and your family. That's Relatively Speaking, Tuesdays only on MPB Think Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Southern Remedy on MPB Think Radio. I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart, professor of internal medicine and pediatrics at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. And this is the Southern Remedy program where you can call in with any type of topic topical question that you might have. Doesn't have to be what the last caller said. You're always welcome to email us any kind of question. We know sometimes listeners aren't able to call in right then and there. Maybe there'll be a little bit of shyness on coming on the air. That's okay. We want to serve you through that route as well. So that is that email address is remedy@mpbonline.org. Hope everybody's having a great Wednesday. A little foggy this morning in central Mississippi, but certainly opened up to a beautiful spring day. And it is spring to me, even though it's not here yet. At least for the day, it's spring. That's probably more accurate. It could be. I think we got a little bit of a colder weather over the weekend, but I hope everybody's enjoying that and taking some time to get out and around as much as I can. I try to do that when I'm walking around on UMMC's campus. I love getting outside and get a little bit of that sunshine and fresh air. So hopefully you're looking for ways to do that too. You know, that's something that a lot of times we have a little bit of blinders on to physical activity and what's appropriate and what's maybe some things that we don't think about. Certainly parking a little bit further from stores and walking in, or maybe taking the stairs instead of the elevator. Incremental increases in your overall physical activity throughout the day can be just as powerful as, say, going to the gym and rolling in a high-intensity class. Those certainly have benefit. But for those of you who have busy schedules, maybe limited resources, those kinds of things can be just as good. In fact, I was looking at a study recently that looked at gardening, particularly for those who are elderly. And no surprises to those of you who know all the benefits from gardening for yourself, but it was just as effective as a regular exercise program, say at a gym. So they compared it against a couple of different activities. And also just being outside and, you know, being productive in something that you can enjoy the benefits of, whether that's just a few tomatoes once a year or whether it's more foods throughout the year. Whatever it is, a lot of people have some positive mental health benefits from that. So that just goes to show, you know, one of the things, discussions I have with my patients when they say, hey, I got to do something different. I'll say, well, that's great. If you want to buy a big fancy pieces of equipment, that's okay. But will you enjoy it and will you stick with it? And you really need to think sort of how you're made up and your goals are to do that. And but thinking about that, that's just we do have the benefit here in the South of having much more days to get outside. Now, I know it is certainly a challenge in the summertime with the heat and humidity, but even then, if you time it just right and you have a little bit of flexibility in your schedule early in the morning, later in the afternoon, those can be beneficial. So just a little bit of a plug there for increased physical activity, something that we talk about frequently on Southern Remedy. If you have any questions about any kind of healthcare topic that involves you, might be a new symptom, might be a new medication, maybe it is a new diagnosis or something you've had for a long time, you just want to hear, hey, is there anything else out there right now on the horizon for what I'm dealing with? You know, we talk a lot. I think it was either last week or the week before we talked about direct-to-consumer advertising and its impact on the doctor-patient relationship and sort of what that means. It's sort of almost like a, you know, some physicians view it as a bypass completely, even though, you know, most of them say, hey, ask your doctor about this, because almost always these aren't over-the-counter medications unless they're supplements. They are prescription medications, and a lot of money goes into these. You may have seen some celebrities on there that maybe you're dealing with these medical problems themselves that are advocating for them. And it does create opportunities, at least, even though it increases the time with a doctor-patient visit, for discussions around those things. So I had mentioned before, you know, it doesn't bother me as much as it does some of my colleagues, because that's another touch point that you can discuss those kinds of things, whether it's in person or whether it's, you know, we have electronic medical records where we can contact, where we have more contact with our patients that way, or even email sometimes in some situations. So, but you do have to realize that that pharmaceutical company or whoever is making that product, they are trying to sell more product. And that's their ultimate goal. There are certainly companies that are very altruistic and certainly develop things, but they're trying to make money off that product. So I think you have to have that in mind when you say, oh, well, maybe I need this. I need to push my physician to do this. There may be some good reasons that it might be appropriate for you, but it also might be some reasons why it may not be good for you. And your physician's going to be the one to really have those discussions with you.
So, Dr. Jimmy, just kind of a quick follow-up to that. How competitive is the drug market, and how is, you know, the companies like take our medicine for this condition as opposed to the other guys?
Yeah, it's Kevin Farrell, our producer, always handy with a good question there or follow-up question. Yeah, it is quite competitive. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but we're talking about in the billions of dollars, tens of billions, probably in the trillions of dollars. I'm probably underestimating it. And it's not just the companies in the U.S., it's foreign countries too, companies too, that things like Pfizer, Novartis, you know, there's lots of different drug companies out there, and they do some fabulous work. And it is very expensive sometimes to develop some of these medications. And then you also have companies that pick up the patent after a medication goes off patent. Then there's an opportunity for another company to buy that up and then start producing that medication. It's also why sometimes when you've been taking a medication for a long time and you may notice that it looks different, the shape of the pill may be different, or perhaps it may be, you know, just a different color. And it's not that most of the time, I definitely would double check with your pharmacist, but it's not that you're getting a totally different medication. It's probably because the company that is currently producing that is producing it a little bit differently. And it's probably more to do with the delivery of it and what it looks like. You know, you could make a tablet, for instance, look any kind of way you want it to. So it may just be the way that their machinery is set up to do that. But it is a very competitive, tight market, particularly of certain things. And there seems to be a rush, you know, over the last 25, 30 years that I've been involved in looking at this. There are times when you have a class of medications, and that first one that comes out, like, for instance, the cholesterol medications with the statins started coming out. And then you had more in that class that, you know, instead of saying, hey, does this work? It was, does it work better than another medication, or does it have other effects of it that might be a little bit more beneficial than others? So there's always a lot of competition in that. But from the patient standpoint, if you think about it, it's nice that they are looking for other things that might benefit you from a medical standpoint. So it does, you know, these studies, sometimes they notice certain things about some medications, like it may be a diabetic medication that also decreases your risk of complications from heart failure, for instance. So it may be in the same class as other medications, but there's something a little bit different in the way that it does it. Just like a lot of people in the same family, you may have the same mannerisms and you may look similar. However, you may have distinct personalities within that family and different things that you do, different jobs that you do. So that's one way to think about that from a medication standpoint. This is Southern Remedy on MPB Think Radio. Dr. Jimmy Stewart with you this morning. answering your calls and questions about any kind of healthcare topic that you may have. Let's go to John from Alabama. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Dr. Jimmy. Good to talk to you.
Yes, sir.
I just turned 70 last week, and this morning I got a call from my doctor's office, and it's time for my annual wellness visit. I haven't really been that impressed with the wellness visits so far because, well, going online, I see sometimes people talking in a chat group about the, you know, what their doctors are doing for their health. And I'm thinking to myself, well, why haven't I seen this? You know, And so how should I handle this wellness visit? It's coming up in the middle of May.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, when it's become sort of a buzzword. So you have to understand, like, what is the wellness visit designed to do? So basically, if you have longstanding medical conditions, like some of the things we always talk about, hypertension, diabetes, high cholesterol, or if you had a stroke or a heart attack, and you may have an autoimmune disease, those are all chronic conditions that your physician or your healthcare provider may be seeing you regularly for. The wellness visits are really designed for what we call primary prevention. In other words, what are the things we can pick up on early that we can do something about? And it changes for different time periods. In other words, we don't do the same thing for a 25-year-old that we would do for, in your case, a 70-year-old, because the risks are different at those points. Not every 25-year-old is going to need screening for atherosclerotic coronary heart disease. And there may be some reasons to do that. And I think a lot of people jump straight to the test, like whether they're labs or whether they're diagnostic tests that we get to do that. And certainly there's a lot of hospitals or some clinics that just sort of run people through at reduced rates and say, hey, you can pay $100 to have your, you know, CT scan of your entire body done or whatever. And that's not really what these are designed for. And it's not really what the science says. The one big concept I think that can help us see what the benefit is and why it may be different for different people is something called pre-test probability. So when a patient comes to see me for anything, including a wellness visit at whatever age, the questions that I ask are very powerful because they give me some information about that patient. And depending on their overall risk, by what they tell me, by their age, by their family history, by the other, there may be some other tools that we use that pull in things like, are they a diabetic, which puts them at higher risk for a stroke or heart attack just by having diabetes. All these things help the physician or the healthcare provider determine the pretest probability of them having something. So, for instance, colon cancer, what's your pretest probability? Well, if you have no first degree or secondary relatives in your family who've had colon cancer and you aren't having any current problems in your GI tract, then it may be appropriate to start those at 45 to 50 years old. And sometimes we have to play around with that because of the insurance company. But if you had a first degree relative that developed colon cancer when they were 45, now we're going to start, your pretest probability is a little bit higher for that. So we're going to start 10 years younger in doing that test. And so it may be a little bit different for people if they're posting things, hey, my doctor did this. And then sometimes doctors use their judgment about certain things. But, you know, a good example of this is a PSA, a prostate specific antibody. So, the PSA is an antigen, not an antibody. So that test, it's a blood test, doesn't have to be done in every individual who is male. We used to do a lot more of them, but then we were like, you know what, this is leading to way too many tests. So we really don't need to be doing it in the very young or maybe even in the very old unless there are symptoms with that. And that, again, sort of feeds into that pretest probability. What's the probability? If the probability is 1% that you may have prostate cancer, that may be low enough that we don't do a PSA. If the probability is 80%, you can bet I'm going to do a PSA. I'm going to do an exam, and we may do some further testing. So I would just, one thing that you can do, John, is you can look and see what's available to you first. So a good place to start is, I'm assuming you have Medicare as your primary?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. I would go to the Medicare website and just search for wellness visit and look at your age at 70 and what they would cover for that. And it may be pretty, you know, that we have cut that down a lot, but the, your physician may be able to add other things based on what you tell them. And I would, before that visit, probably write down all the things that you're concerned about. If you're going to the bathroom more at night, or if you have blood in your stool or shortness of breath, that's a little bit more than usual when you walk down the street or up a flight of stairs. Those are all things that they can use to help determine that. Hopefully they're asking you all those questions. And Medicare is a good example of an insurance company in some way. It's just government funded. So it has a specific set of questions for different ages that they require for that visit. So and I, the biggest thing I find is patients say, I don't feel like they really did anything. They just ask me questions. 90% of the time, you can make a diagnosis off the history alone, and we add about 8% probability to getting the right diagnosis by a thorough physical exam that's targeted based off that history. And then the rest of the time, anywhere from 2 to 5%, that's probably what you're going to get from labs or tests to really confirm that diagnosis. So that's probably more than you wanted to hear, but that's sort of how it gets into it about, like, why do we do certain things in wellness and why do we don't? Some things we drop off. Like once you reach a certain age, you sort of opt out of that. If you're 85 years old and you're a woman and you've been getting mammograms your whole life, you probably don't need them at that point. Your likelihood of getting breast cancer, goes down considerably after a certain age. So those kinds of things do go into that. But I would start off with the Medicare wellness visit and then think about any other things that you're having that might, you know, be something that you're concerned about. That's the best barometer for, you know, saying things to your doctor. Don't feel like you're going to, you know, that's your time with your doctor to really say, what can I do? And ask them really broad questions like, what can I do to get healthier in the next 10 years? How can I live the best life that I can possibly live for the remaining time that I have, particularly as you get older?
Well, let's see. For about the past 5 years, old age things have been starting to crop up that I never had a problem with.
Mm-hmm.
Joints that, are quick to cause problems, skin issues, and stuff like that. And I've been seeing this doctor so long, since 1994, that I think he's just used to seeing me as a generally healthy person. And, they take blood samples for testing. He asks me a few questions, but I'm not sure he really hears me.
Yeah, so, I'd try to use language that would get his attention, like, hey, doc, I know I've been seeing you a long time, but I am very concerned about your skin. Point to the area. This is really bothering me a lot. Use language that's going to increase their level of, you know, to sort of focus on it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your help.
Yes, sir. Thank you for listening. Thank you for calling in. We do appreciate it. This is Southern Remedy. Dr. Jimmy with you this morning. You can always email us. That email address is remedy@mpbonline.org. Let's go to Shannon from Ridgeland. Good morning, Shannon.
Good morning. How are you doing, doctor?
Good. Thank you for asking. What's your question for today?
Well, sir, I was just diagnosed this morning after several tests with gastroparesis.
Mm-hmm.
And can you tell me just a little bit about it? I got the information over the phone, and I just want to get a little bit more information.
Sure. So gastroparesis refers to, it's a faulty way that you're in. Some people, they don't digest food. Food doesn't move through, particularly the stomach area, like it should. So when we eat, You know, you chew up your food, you swallow it, it goes to the stomach, and that first part of digestion actually occurs starting in the mouth, but your stomach continues that. And there, depending on it, the body's really good at feedback on this. It's amazing that we don't have more problems with it. But in the normal situation, the stomach is going to only allow food to stay there for the appropriate amount of time and then move it out into the first part of the small intestine, into the duodenum. So there are valves at both in the entrance of the stomach and the exit of the stomach that help that. And then there's signals to the stomach through nerves that control that, like the vagus nerve is the biggest nerve that sort of contributes to that, and all kinds of different hormonal signals. If you get a problem that happens to that system, then food can stay there too long and doesn't move. And then you get symptoms like nausea, vomiting, bloating that you can get. And the most common cause of that is actually diabetes. So either uncontrolled diabetes or diabetes that you've had for at least, usually it's about 5 to 15 years-ish. With most people. Some people don't, though. And the thought is that it affects the nerves to the stomach itself to help, you know, give it the signals to move that food on at the appropriate time. There are some medications to help treat this. And there's also a pacemaker for the stomach, if you want to think of it that way. Like we have pacemakers that help with the electrical activity if it's faulty in the heart. They also have designed one that helps with the stomach to give it the right kind of electrical stimulation so that it moves food out appropriately. But a gastroenterologist who is trained in that area is who you want to be seeing, because they're going to. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
And I figured
that's exactly who I'm seeing.
Yeah, I figured that's it. Right. And just so I know, you know this because you probably had the test done, but they do something called a gastric emptying study where they get you to swallow this stuff. And it basically they take pictures of it and see how much of it is left in your stomach after a certain period of time. So that's one of the diagnostic tests to follow up with the symptoms that you have.
Had that yesterday.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate the information. I just wanted to get it a little bit more because my doctor was tied up and I talked to the nurse practitioner. I have it complete faith in. But I do have a follow-up appointment with my
good
GI doctor.
Good.
Just wanted to get a little bit more information on it.
Yeah, and when you go back to, because I'm sure even in the visit, there's all kinds of information that may be available to you. Ask them if there's some information that you can go to, like on the internet or anything to read after that. Because the more you read about something that you have, the better you're going to do across the board with whatever you have.
Well, I have a very nice doctor's office who's going to put together a report for me and mail it to me with some dietary guidelines.
Perfect.
And go from there.
That sounds perfect. So, yeah, that sounds like you've got a good team on your side and a good plan.
I think so. Well, after talking with you, I think so.
All right, Shannon, thank you for calling, and good luck to you moving forward with that diagnosis. This is Southern Remedy on MPB Think Radio. Dr. Jimmy with you this morning, answering your calls and questions. We've got some good ones so far. Looking forward to the latter half of the hour here with some more. Let's go to Chris from Vicksburg. Morning, Chris.
Yes, sir. I also want to ask you about a medication. I'm sure I'm saying it wrong. Helios or Helioz. It's for non-24.
Can you spell that for me?
Oh, no, sir. I'm sorry. I can't.
it's Helios?
Like Helios or Helioz. That's what I understand. It's for non-24. It's for, the way I understand it, it's for visually impaired or blind people that can't regulate the sun.
Oh, okay. Okay. I think I know what you're referring to. Yeah. I don't know. And I'll be honest with you. I don't know a whole lot about that. Ophthalmology has a lot of new emerging medications. So, is that something that you've been prescribed?
My doctor's talking about it, and I just want some more information on it. Yeah,
and to be honest, I'm not going to blow smoke and say, yeah, I know what that is. That's I don't know a whole lot about it, but the ophthalmologist is going to be the experts on it. So ask them, call back. You don't have to talk to them directly. The nurses probably can get in touch with them and get the information that you need. Find out everything you can about it, including the possible benefits and the possible side effects. And that maybe that can help you make make that and what it's going to cost, too, because that may come into play.
Well, that's And like I said, I was probably saying the word wrong. So anyway,
no, that's OK. Look, I say these words long that they're big words. Right. Like I have problems with them sometimes, too. And some days more than others I do. So, but yeah, and was that for just light sensitivity? Is that what you're having problems with? Oh, we lost him. Oh, yeah. So that sounds like, and that's something certainly that no matter what medication you've been prescribed or that talked about, before you leave the office, just sort of get in your mind like, hey, if they tell me about something, I'm going to say, hey, do you have more information you can give me or point me in the right direction? Because I can't tell you how many times patients have left, and I thought as the physician, well, I told them everything they need to know. And they may have some very specific good questions about them and about that medication that they need to ask. So that's always a good idea to say, you know, is there some information you can give me? A lot of times I'll print out something on their what's called an after visit summary that they can access either electronically or sort of print out, and that can help them after the fact. This is Southern Remedy. Dr. Jimmy with you this morning. The number to call is 1-877-MPB-RING. That's 1-877-672-7464. A lot of people are asking about continuous glucose monitors. And you may have seen these advertised. Again, we talked about sort of direct-to-consumer advertising. Most often for diabetic patients, and basically throughout the day and the night, this is a device that has a very small little needle that is accessible into the skin, and you wear this device, and it basically tells you what your glucose is. It can download to your phone through Bluetooth. Your physician's office can, when you come in to see them, you can get that information off of it, and it helps really to see what your blood glucose is doing throughout the day and the night. And again, very useful in diabetic patients. I do have some patients that have said, hey, I just want to monitor it just for kicks. And if that's what you want to do and pay money for it, it has become the FDA has approved the first over-the-counter glucose monitor. So you can go now and buy one yourself, and it may be useful. I would caution you, though, that, you know, blood glucose does go up and down throughout the day and night. It is highly modulated and highly variable depending on what you eat and the types of food that you eat, when you eat, and your physical activity and other things that are going on. Like if you have a secondary illness, even mild illnesses like the common cold or sinusitis, that may affect it. Medications sometimes affect blood glucose. So it can be all kinds of different things. So if you don't have diabetes and you just want to sort of see what your glucose is, that may be some information that you get. But and if it will help you modulate what you're doing, if you're at risk for diabetes, then that may be useful. But outside of that, there's probably not a whole lot of impetus for you getting that. Now, a lot of people would say, well, what is this really? What do I gain from this? Any more than just sticking myself, you know, in the morning, getting a fasting glucose, maybe one other one in the afternoon, and then that 3-month average of what your blood sugar is, that blood test that the doctor can do either in the office or at the lab, which is a hemoglobin A1C. Those are all very useful things, but the continuous blood glucose monitor can do that throughout the day. So if you notice, for instance, that your A1C might be very well controlled, it might be less than 6. Which would be very tight control of your diabetes, but you may be dipping down a little bit too low, particularly at night, then this would help do that. I mean, you really, some patients, depending on, you know, individuals, they may not notice that. They may not wake up in the night with a blood glucose of 50 or 60, and this would help catch that. Or it might show different parts of the day where they're getting an abnormal spike in their blood glucose. Maybe it's going to 220, 250, maybe even 300. But the rest of the time, it's very well controlled. So they might want to modify how they're eating or what they're eating at different times of the day, or adjust the medications that they're taking for diabetes. So they are very useful in looking at that 24-hour range, and it's really, they're pretty minimal as far as size goes, and they're very easy for patients to, I found all my patients who have them, I don't know of anybody that really hasn't been able to do it. And every single one of them, once they get invested in it and they monitor it, it's just like anything else. And we said this earlier today, the more you know about your chronic illness, the better you're going to do with it. And that feedback of seeing that number, like, oh, I shouldn't have eaten that, or maybe I need to do more physical activity. I can see the effects of it, the positive effects of it on my glucose. So those kinds of things can help reinforce what a patient needs to do and how well medications work. But you may see that. That's probably going to be in the news because that's hot off the press. I think yesterday is when they announced it. But that's going to be something that you see at all pharmacies now, is a glucose monitor that you can get over the counter. So it's not for everybody to do. I mean, I know some sports guys are doing that, and lactate analysis and all kinds of fancy stuff, maybe VO2 max. That costs you a lot of money. And if you're not a competitive athlete, you probably don't need to know any of that. So just some thoughts there. Still have a lot of patients that ask me about blood pressure goals for them. And that's a very common topic that comes up. I've just got through talking about some of the nuances with diabetes. Hypertension can be very nuanced too. One of my patients, or actually two of my patients yesterday, we had a considerable discussion around, hey, my blood pressure goes up in the late afternoon or the night, but in the mornings it's very low. I'm really concerned about the elevations. Do we need to add a medication or increase medication? And in some instances, you don't need to do that because of the way that blood pressure medications work. And ideally, you want a blood pressure medication that is very smooth in the way it works. In other words, it's going to be in your system throughout the day and night for at least a full 24 hours, if not longer. And then once you taken that at around the same time every day, or if you're on multiple medications at different times of the day, depending on what your physician has said, hopefully that's going to smooth things out as that blood pressure response. But you also need to realize that blood pressure, just like our blood sugar, goes up and down throughout the day and night. So for everybody, whether you have hypertension or whether you don't, blood pressure at night goes down about 20%. So that is a good bit. So somebody who has a normal blood pressure of 120 over 80, they may be dipping down into 90 over 50 at night, and that is perfectly normal for them. But if you're 82 and your blood pressure is 180 over 60 in the afternoons, but in the mornings it's 100 over 50, that may be a problem. It might be a little bit too low. So we wouldn't necessarily just treat the highs. We have to know about the lows. And we need to ask questions like, when you get up from the bed to in the night to go use a restroom, do you get dizzy or lightheaded? Because your blood pressure may be too low during that period if that's the case. Or if you're just getting up from the chair to standing, you know, what happens? Have you had any falls lately? All those things sort of play into that. But for the general population, most of us, particularly here in Mississippi, if you do have hypertension, a lot of patients aren't adequately controlled. For somebody who doesn't have any other problems and is relatively healthy otherwise, and you have hypertension, your goal should be at least less than 130 over 80. And that's a little bit different than the data that we had, say, 10, 15 years ago, when it was a little bit higher than we shot for less than 140 over 90. But now we know that a little bit lower actually is better. And we're probably going to get some more information about this the next time the hypertension guidelines are improved based on the science that's out there. We do know from a population standpoint, though, that a blood pressure starting at about 115 over 75 is sort of the optimal. And as you rise from that, you increase your risk of heart attack and particularly stroke. So that's a continuum. Now, it's not just like a cutoff for the general population, but we're learning more and more about those treatment goals. This is Southern Remedy on MPB Think Radio. Dr. Jimmy with you this morning, answering your calls and questions. If you're not able to call today, please email us. That email address is remedy@mpbonline.org. We're going to go to Archie from Brookhaven. Good morning, Archie.
Morning.
What's your question this morning?
I've been having the shingles.
Uh-huh, the shingles. Okay. All right. So you've had shingles for a while. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Almost a whole year. I simply can't get rid of it.
Are they still breaking out, or are you just having the pain where they were?
Pain where they were?
Yeah, that's a tough one. So there are some things that can help with that. Are you taking any medications like gabapentin, or Neurontin is another name for it?
I don't try it. Well, my primary doctor gave me that. It ain't working, though.
Yeah, that's one of the things that people have used. The other thing is a topical cream that has something called capsaicin in it. And there's multiple of these out there, and sometimes they can help if you put that sort of as a salve over the area.
Okay.
The other thing that I've done is in patients that are still having problems that long out, is I have retreated them with an antiviral medication that is used to treat the virus that actually causes that to begin with. And that's something like valacyclovir is the name of it, or there's an older one called acyclovir. But I would try that. Are you putting anything on it like cream?
No, nothing.
Yeah, because usually it's really tender to the touch. But I would maybe, you know, ask your pharmacist about that, where you get your medication, and say, hey, do y'all have any cream that Dr. Jimmy told me there was something like capsaicin in it, okay. That may help you, you know, at least with the pain and the discomfort, because it can be really debilitating.
No one.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Dr. Noway.
Yes, sir. Thank you for calling. We're going to go to Lizzie from Jackson. Good morning, Lizzie.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good.
I have a question about colon cancer. My partner had their first annual screening. No risk factors that we know of in the family. No one has had cancer. No underlying, you know, conditions. As healthy, as young, as 45. So this was their first time to have a colonoscopy, and we were shocked that they found a large number of polyps, 8 polyps, along with a large mass. And they immediately sent us the same day for both the CT scan and for a consult with a general surgeon to have this section of colon that has the large mass removed. And so it's been bam, 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 just in the last kind of 48 hours, all of this has unfolded. We're moving to surgery tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered if that was kind of a typical approach and progression. Folks that I've talked to have said, I can't believe you haven't talked to oncology first. And it seems to me that this approach is kind of get this out and then go to oncology. And I just didn't know if that was typical, if we were making a mistake and needed to slow down and back up, or if this is sometimes how it's handled.
Yeah, so that is sort of the typical route. It may differ a little bit. Like sometimes you go and see an oncologist, but until the surgeon does their bit on that to see, number one, to remove the mass, to confirm the diagnosis that way, but also to take the regional lymph nodes. So they'll do a sampling of lymph nodes to see if that cancer is spread beyond that section of colon, because that will change what the follow-up treatment would be. And then also, once they take out the segment, they're going to send that to pathology to see how deep through the wall of the intestine that it's gone. So all those things are important, so it does make sense. And usually the surgeons that do this, it may even be an oncologic surgeon. In other words, there is further training within surgery. Certainly a general surgeon might be doing this, but an oncology surgeon might be doing it and then can hand off to the medical oncologist for the other treatment. And they sometimes work hand in hand. But the first step would be that tissue diagnosis and the removal of that mass and the sampling of lymph nodes, because then there's a complex staging algorithm to really see what works in under those circumstances. And it's different if you have, you know, if it has spread further than the wall, if it is in lymph nodes, then it's a little, you can't just do what you would for anybody. You have to sort of, you know, again, sort of narrow that down. And that may be chemo. That might be, there's really good neoadjuvant therapy to, that's really immunotherapy. That's very targeted with the immune system. That's been very, very successful in advanced forms of colon cancer. So, and it may be, you know, best case scenario that you resect the whole thing. They got good margins. It hadn't really spread. The lymph nodes are clean. And they, you, that may be all that you do at that point, but it'll just, it'll depend on that. It'll depend on the type of cells that are in there. But that is the first information beyond the colonoscopy. Certainly that's the first information, but then if there are problems, that's the next step. So I would say that's, it sounds to me like they're marching in that direction. But that's sort of what to expect and the questions that you would need to ask moving there.
Okay. Well, we are definitely believers in this screening now, and are glad that the age has been dropped down to 45.
Yep.
Is there ever a way to know what caused this? If there's no family history, no symptoms, no exposure that we know of, is there any way to know why?
Yeah, we typically think it's direct. It's the cells of the colon that, well, number one, they turn over really fast. So they're exposed, anything that's exposed to external things. And we tend to think of skin, you know, like the longer you have skin on your body, the more risk there is of neoplastic skin cells, just because of they're exposed to everything, including UV light. Same thing with our intestinal cells. They're exposed to the foods we eat. And there are, even if you don't have a family history, there are certain foods over time that we think do contribute to this. It has been associated with, for instance, people who eat more processed foods, salty foods, and burned foods, if you want to think of it that way. Not like cooked in the normal way, but just really excessively cooked. So those are some of the things that may be contributing to it. But sometimes it just happens.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Lizzie. Southern Remedy is a production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting Think Radio and is funded in part by a grant from the University of Mississippi Medical Center. I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart, professor of pediatrics and internal medicine at UMMC. Southern Remedy is produced by Kevin Farrell, and the podcast producer is Abram Nanny. You can tune in to MPB Think Radio every weekday morning at 11 for the full Southern Remedy lineup.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.